This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Wow. Okay, I am here in the studio, and I am so happy to be back in the studio. I love this place. It's so great. Even though it smells like Clorox and Lysol, I'm holding them up. Here I am on YouTube if you're watching. Clorox and Lysol have become a girl's best friend.
Well, you know, I wipe down after every guest, so it's...
We know you do, Ed, and we thank you so much for all of your hard work here, keeping the studio going.
I have the cleanest hands in radio.
That's wonderful. Well, Ed, it's delightful to be back here because I look forward to you saluting me at the end of every program. And so... this is particularly exciting for me today because I am going to be talking to one of my favorite authors. And I just adjusting things here a little bit because, you know, I'm not even touching everything. But I do want to say in a minute I'm going to be talking to to Tim McGee. And he has been on the program a number of times. And I just enjoy talking to him so much because he has a book that's particularly relevant at this time of the year and a book that touches my heart every time I read it. But first, I want to thank, again, my son for coming down from Madison, Wisconsin. And I think he missed out on the last snow or something. Anyway, he's here. And I want to thank him so much for being here. And to my goddaughter, Kanisha. Kanisha, thank you so much. She grew this absolutely beautiful little cactus for me and for Mother's Day, and I'm just so thrilled with it. And I just want to thank both of them for being here. And of course, just for everyone out there, just be thankful for all the people in your family and your friends. And I count Tim McGee among my friends because I am so thrilled to talk to you, Tim.
Well, thank you.
You know,
how are you?
Well, I'm doing okay. And, you know, it's coming on to that time of the year, to D-Day, which always reminds me of my father because, of course, he was in D-Day. And a few days later, once they, you know, got over the cliffs, a few days later, he was awarded a Silver Star for bravery. Wow. And so a book about D-Day is always something that interests me. But your book, Worthy McGuire, is, I think, one of the very best.
Well, thank you.
Well, you know, what it is for many people, you know, for people who... parents, or in most cases now grandparents, were in the war. They don't quite have a grasp of it. You know, they see movies, they're not sure exactly what happened. And I think the way that you've told this story about a man who, well, I'll let you explain who Worthy is. But
okay.
What I love about the story is that it unfolds. And we learn about D-Day. We learn the importance of family because we start off with a very dysfunctional family. And so that's why I think at this time when we're all, you know, in our pandemic mode, many people are looking at their families and they're saying, are we dysfunctional or should we not be dysfunctional? And I thought in this book... in Worthy McGuire, you capture it. In the beginning, they are so dysfunctional, you almost hate everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that it unfolds and the story that you tell is beautiful. So do you tell us about it and tell us about Worthy?
Sure. So as you said, it's really a story about... Worthy is set in 2012. So he's a World War II vet. When you first meet him, he is... nearing the end of his life, and makes the decision that he wants to fulfill a promise he made during the war, during the invasion. So he decides, I'm going to do this, and he recognizes very early on that he can't do this alone. He's in his late 80s. He's planning on traveling. He lives in the suburbs of Detroit in Michigan, so he's planning on traveling back to Europe. And so all of his contemporaries, his friends, are either as fragile as he is or sadly passed away. So he has to turn to his family. And you recognize early on that it's a fairly dysfunctional family. But then, you know, all families are pretty dysfunctional. But I think they may win some sort of award.
Oh, but, yeah. They're rather amusing about it.
Yeah. And so I try to frame it so that it's not there. It's more of like a business trip for him. He reached out initially to his grandson, and Worthy was successful in the auto business, and his son has inherited his business, and Worthy's relationship with his son is very, very strained, and as a result, Worthy doesn't really know his grandkids all that well, but he reaches out to the grandson and says, basically, I need a pack mule. I need someone to come with me and carry bags and you know, hail taxis and things like that. So it's not framed as this is going to be a nice family vacation. And so the grandson agrees to go because he is really stressed with his father. He works for his father in the car industry and hates it. So initially, Worthy just wanted his grandson to go, and his granddaughter, who also is very stressed with her dad and Worthy's son, begs him to come along because they both just want to get away. They will do anything to get away. So, yeah, they are when they get on the plane in Detroit, it's not a family vacation. There are two younger people who just want a break. And this older gentleman who just is focused on, I need to get this thing done before it's too late. So, and Worthy, you know, I'll say people always ask me when they read about Worthy, because he is a curmudgeon. He's, you know, he's this really kind of cranky old guy. And it's like, where'd he come from? And I was like, well, actually, I based him on a very good friend of mine who was a colleague of my father's. He was like a second father to me, and I grew up with him, and he had the really dry, kind of sarcastic sense of humor, and so he was my framework for Worthy.
Well, and a wonderful framework it turned out to be, because it is my D-Day book. I read it every year, because there's a subtlety to this story, exactly, that they are going along for a ride, you know, for their own purposes. They have no intention of making this into something, you know, that is going to touch their hearts, because, in fact, they are pretty hard-hearted at this point in their lives. So
yeah.
And Worthy himself. And then how you do it, I don't want to give everything away, because I really want people, I think, you know, this is the kind of book that as you're reading it and it unfolds, first, I get angry. I'm going to tell you the truth. What really makes me angry is that this book was not published by a major publisher, because I want more people to read it. There are so many lessons in this book, lessons about first of all, about writing. This, where did you come out as such a great writer? You had been a business guy, right?
Yeah. I spent 25 years working in the corporate grind, as it were.
And then...
It's always something I've always loved writing, and I read tons of books, so...
And then you come out with, I consider this, you know, you know how many books I read and how many books I review and how many books I've admired. But there are few books that I feel so strongly that this should be what they call in the business an evergreen, a book that is published every year around the same time, like a Christmas book. This is mm-hmm. should be a D-Day book. And I'm not going to rest until I find a publisher who will reprint this book, because you self-published it. Mm-hmm. You know, you wanted to get it out there. And sometimes that's, you know, for all of you writers out there, you have a choice. You know, if you want to, if you have the opportunity and you have the nerves to try to find a publisher, so many times that is better. But nowadays, of course, being self-published can be great, but it's self-publishing is a difficult job, because you have to be also a promoter. You have to mm-hmm. you have to do the work. Yeah. And so that's what I think of. This is a book that people can read 20 years from now, 50 years from now, because everybody has a relative, who was in the invasion, or mm-hmm. a relative or people that they, you know, can relate to. And so that's why I want more power. I'm going to tell you one thing. I discovered something important here. I really need to get more powerful in the publishing world, because when I say that a book should be read, this is a book that should be read. And just in so many ways that you've created a real little mini masterpiece here.
Well, thank you. You know, I mean, I'll talk about the self-publishing, and you're right. It's a challenge, and it was very rewarding and very challenging. And like you said, the real hard part is the promoting of it. And the creative was the least amount of work in terms of, you know, it was, and that was a very, very big aha for me. I have self-published one other book, and I, to your point, I've gone the route. I've sent out hundreds of query letters for Worthy, as well as for, I have three other manuscripts that I've finished. And, you know, gotten some very nice rejection letters from literary agents, but it's a worthy challenge for me. I love to write, and, will continue to write,
and you are so talented, and this is a problem sometimes. And it's a combination of things. Query letters I actually hate them. I think talk about judgmental. Yeah. And the thing is, I have talked to agents. I was at a bar with an agent one time, and this is a truth. I mean, there we are sitting, and so I'm trying to bring up, you know, I'm trying to sort of pick her mind and find out what you know, how she finds books. And I mean, the things that she told me that she would reject a query letter were like a joke. I mean, a misspelling, the wrong tense of a verb. I mean, ridiculous things. And I must say, you know, I was very, very disappointed in her. I had really thought, you know, this is great. But in many ways, this is what happens. And, mm-hmm. and it's sad, because I think this book should be read completely, because then you get the magnitude of the story, what you've accomplished, the insight into human nature, the mm-hmm. clear, beautiful writing. I just need to get to another level where I can have some power. So when I tell somebody in New York, I want you to publish this book, they'll actually listen to me. Because,
well, I'm right there with you.
You know, because to have a book, to have an evergreen book, a book that, you know, so many, I have thousands of books, and that I read them once and they're fine, and I enjoy them, but I'm not going to go back and read them every year. I mean, it's not like they're not like Charlotte Bronte, that I'm going to go back and read mm-hmm. The Professor, my favorite book probably in the world, that I read every year. But mm-hmm. your book, I will read every year, and it's just so frustrating to me So I'm going on a big campaign now to try to get myself more. You know, the publishers love me, and they send me books, and I get a lot of, you know, nice feedback. But now I'm going to try. You know, this fifth anniversary of Joy on Paper came and went too fast because mm-hmm. we had this pandemic. I had hoped to use it as an opportunity to exactly do this, become an influencer, so that I can influence the publishers, because I have a good eye. When I read a book and it's good, I know it, and it's the type of thing that I want to get, you know, out to people. So I just...
Well, yeah, I'm there with you, so anything you can do, I'd be appreciative. But you know, I published this in, I think it was 2012, so it's been 8 years, and I do appreciate the comments, and I, when I put it out there, I thought it was a good story, and I thought I wanted to write it. You know, my original intention was to write something that was to honor the greatest generation. My father was in the Army, and I can remember when. He never talked about it, like all veterans. He never talked. You know, I remember as a kid asking him, "Dad, would you, you know, were you in the war?" And he's like, "Yeah, I was in the Army," and that was it. And he passed away when I was 32, and probably 10 years later, my grandmother said to me that she had these letters that he wrote when he was in the war, and I was astounded. I said, "What?" And so she gave me this stack of letters, and that I put them aside. I was like, "Oh yeah, there they are," and put them aside. And then when I got to deciding when I wanted to start writing full time, I remembered we had moved from New Jersey down to Florida, and I dug these letters out and read them, and I was just stunned at because I knew he was he graduated 1944, and he joined the Army right away. And I can remember thinking when I was 18 and I graduated high school, I didn't join the, you know, I was looking for the next graduation party. And he went off to fight in the war, and he was living in Michigan and was put on a train to a training basic camp in Texas, where he was, you know, he thought, okay, I'm going to go to basic training and then off I go wherever I go. And he was pulled aside at the end of his training, and I think it's 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something like that. And he was told that he was going to be kept back as a trainer, a drill sergeant, because he was one of the few in his company who could read and write. And he, in his letters, and so he never told me all this stuff, but in his letters, he was pretty upset about that, because he felt like he was letting all of his buddies down by not going with them overseas. And so he wrote letters almost on a weekly basis to his mom and dad. And through these letters, he was kind of frustrated, but he also heard back from his comrades who were fighting in what was essentially the Battle of Normandy after the invasion. And they said, and his name was Teddy, and they're like, "Teddy, you do whatever you can not to come over here." You know, he was like this, and they were this, you stay where you are, and you know, you're better as a drill sergeant. And you know, just reading that, was that really hit me with just the magnitude of it, the sacrifice that all of these 18, 19, 20 year old kids made, and you know, for fighting in the war. And so that was when I read those letters, and I talked to my grandmother a little bit about it, and that was kind of the impetus. I said, "All right, this is, I want to do this and put this book together." And so it was really and I appreciate your comments on it. I do. You know, it was a very satisfying. I would love to have more people read it, obviously, but it was very satisfying for me to get it out there. I learned a lot through the self-publishing, and I learned a lot of the challenges and have decided, you know, going forward, I'm actually going to self-publish another book in a couple of months. So, you know, trying to learn all those lessons and learn from all those fits and starts I did the first time, I'm going to do it again.
Well, you know, I hope that I will get an advanced copy, and of course
you will.
Hopefully, you will be able to come into the studio for an interview by then. And it is difficult, and I think things are even more difficult right now because, wow, all of the book conferences and all of those things have been canceled for the summer, which is a big time for authors to get out there and to promote their books. All of that is gone.
It's a whole brave new world, isn't it?
It is, and that's why it is going to be even more challenging being self-published. Even the publishers, I'm getting it's funny, you know, the publishers are sending me emails. They say, listen, we can't publish this book. The book's coming out, but we can't send you advanced copies because, you know, will you read a PDF? Will you please read the PDF? Because everything's tight about printing because, well, I'm sure we can imagine where most of our books are printed too. So, you know, everything is difficult. You know, Kindle sales are nice, although, you know, yours is you're not getting anything. It's going to be a challenge. But of course, part of this is what, you know, I always talk about is that there is a real writer writes, even though they're not going to get you know, published by a publisher. They write because you write from the heart. You have things to say. You have things that you want to share. And I look forward, you know, to having you here in the studio and to reading your book soon. And again, I want to thank you for this because I think that it was the greatest generation. I don't know, this new generation, I hope that they can survive it. You know, some of them are like going over the edge, and it's hard. It's terrible. But as you said, they were 18 years old. My dad was so young, and they're climbing, you know, and breaching those horrible cliffs, and taking unbelievable fire, but they did it. And so I think about my dad. I think about your book, and I want to thank you so much, Tim, for being on the program today.
The book is
Worthy McGuire by Tim McGee, and it's available on Kindle on if people
on
don't
Amazon.
And of course you can send a paperback book, a real printed book, to anyone you know in your family who has anybody who was in World War II or who wants to read about a dysfunctional family with some humor. That's what I love about this, too. It's not all serious, I can tell you. It cracked me up in quite a few places. So, again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Tim.
Okay, cheers. Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye
all
now.
Right, bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to commercials. And when we come back, oh, my goodness, things to talk about.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I have a few minutes here. I just want to say, you know, some people call me America's book lover, partly because I read over 10,000 books, but mostly because I like to help people find that thing I call joy on paper. If you're a reader, you know what joy is when you find a book that just grabs you, that takes you to another era, another place in time. And that is joy. And then, of course, if you are a writer, it's the absolute joy that you feel when you see your words on paper. And, of course, it's something that is almost a miracle when a character takes over your life and gives you a whole nother dimension. So that's joy on paper. And I'd love to encourage everybody to read. And people are always asking me, well, Patsy, what are you reading? And I have so many books that I love. The last one recently was Valerie Trouet's book, Tree Story, The History of the World Written in Rings. And that's an amazing book, and I hope that you'll get it. And now I can turn to my guest because this is, you know, very exciting to be back in the studio. But I have on the phone an author whose book this is a strange time, and the book comes out, you know, at a strange time in our history. And I'm really excited to talk to Bernice Lerner. The title of her book is All the Horrors of War, A Jewish Girl, A British Doctor, and the Liberation of Bergen-Belsen. Hi, Bernice.
Hi.
Wow. Okay. You know, who knew we would be in the middle of a pandemic when this book came out? But I wanted to make sure that, you know, I talked to you because it is an important book. And although at this point in time, people might say, oh, horrors of war, I'm not sure I can handle it. In so many ways, there are lessons to be learned here, not just about the war, and about really wonderful people, but also the lesson that of what a person can do when they start writing.
When they start writing.
When you've taken a story, you took a story and you've turned it into a book, a very compelling book. And I want to go back a step. You tell us about this book. First of all, how, you know, it's a story from your own life. And tell us about the book.
Yeah, so the story began, it was inspired by a question. I had finished another book about Holocaust survivors, no one from my family. And now I wanted to turn, I finally was ready to sort of turn my attention to my own family. And my parents were both survivors. And so I had a question about my mother, which was, how precisely did she survive? And I knew a lot of the stories that she had told me over the years. She was 14 years old when she was deported with her family to Auschwitz. She was from Siget, the same town as Elie Wiesel. And she barely survived. She had gone through She had her parents and four younger siblings were murdered in Auschwitz, and she and her sister were miraculously selected to work in a slave labor camp. And after that came a death march. And then after that, she was dumped with 1,000 other people in a place that was a hell called Bergen-Belsen. In the winter of 1945, the people who had already survived so much had escaped the gas chambers and slave labor and death marches. The Nazis tried to march them away from liberating Allied forces, and Bergen-Belsen was the largest dumping ground. So how did she survive? She fell unconscious, and she couldn't tell me exactly how she was rescued. So from that question, I started to try to learn all I could about the liberation and the exact process of saving people, which, believe it or not, has some parallels to the pandemic today and trying to save people. And I came across the man most prominently associated with the liberation, who was Brigadier Glenn Hughes. And I started to look into this man and to try to figure out, was he biography worthy? And it turns out he was a really compelling character that the world didn't know about. He was sort of an Oscar Schindler type figure in that he had tremendous empathy and compassion for the victims. And they really, his encounters with them were a watershed in his life and changed his life thereafter. So I did a lot of research about Glenn Hughes, and this started probably 15, 16 years ago. I tracked down every last person on the earth who remembered him or who knew him. I tried. He had died in 1973. So even when I was interviewing people in 2004, 2005, 2007, these were people who were in their 80s. So I tried to get all the information I could, and I started to write about him. And then I decided at some point to write about my mother as well and to braid the two journeys, and told their stories over 1 year, the last year of the war, the last very eventful, dramatic year, beginning in the spring of 1944 when he's planning for the D-Day invasion and as deputy director of medical services of the Corps in the British Second Army. He was responsible for the evacuation and treatment of wounded soldiers. And there was my mother, who was in her town in Siget, about to be rounded up with all the other Jews in her town and taken away to this place called Auschwitz. So I tell the story by season, from the spring of 1944 to the spring of 1945, when these two protagonists converge in this camp in Northwest Germany, where there were 60,000 inmates, 25,000 of whom needed immediate hospitalization, and 10,000 corpses strewn around the camp that needed to be buried. And during the first 4 months of 1945, 36,000 people died in Bergen-Belsen. Death was the norm. What happened to Anne Frank was the norm. She probably died the month of March, early March, where 17,000 people died in Bergen-Belsen. So how did my mother just manage to make it through? And that's how I started. I started with the question, how did my mother survive? And truth be told, had the British Army come just 3 or 4 days later, I wouldn't be here to write the story. She would not have survived.
Survived and thrived. When did she come to America?
So she came to America in 1956. Yeah, 1956. She was 15 years old at the war's end, so she was one of the youngest who survived. And she spent 10 years after the war. The Swedish government took in about 7,000 of the very sick survivors and aim to put them on their feet. The idea was they would, you know, do this humanitarian thing and rehabilitate them, and then they would maybe stay 6 months and then go on their way. And my mother stayed 10 years in Sweden after the war, in and out of tuberculosis sanatorium. So she would say the teenage years of her life, the best years of her life, were she was spent in hospitals. But it gave her time to heal before she married and had children.
And so in many ways, you yourself are a real miracle, right?
Yes. And yes, me and my children and grandchildren.
It's wonderful. I was the president of the St. Petersburg chapter of Hadassah. So I had, you know, an opportunity, to work with many Holocaust survivors and to get to know them over the years, as we did different projects, Days of Remembrance and things like that. And so here, and of course we have a Holocaust Museum here in St. Petersburg. So knowing this story, knowing, and of course having been to, my family, we went for the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Uprising. We went to where my mother-in-law was born. And she, luckily, they left for Israel before the war. But most of the family was killed there. And so it's a very personal story from my side to think of this. But what I did find so fascinating, as you said, this story of I had not heard about Glenn Hughes. I had not known about this story. So tell us more about him and who was he? Where did he come from?
So first, you had a fascinating trip, and your mother-in-law, is it?
Yes.
Was that your mother-in-law who escaped from Poland?
Well, she left, luckily she left Poland early, leaving most of the family behind, and they didn't survive. So it's just...
So you definitely have a personal connection.
Oh, yes.
So Glenn Hughes, so who was this guy? Who was this man? Well, at the time that he came into Bergen-Belsen, he was already quite seasoned military officer. He was 52 years old. He had been a regimental medical officer in World War I and the longest serving regimental medical officer. He knew all 600 men in the 1st Wiltshire Battalion by name, and he was a real war hero. He was he would take up arms if he had to and go into battle. And he was kind of an unusual, courageous character, but he didn't start out life that way. He was orphaned as a toddler, 2 years old. Not orphaned, but his father had died, and his mother, he was raised in poverty. And he was a very sickly child, and he had his own personal experience of liberation, I would say, because the doctor said that he would forever be puny, and he has some spinal condition, and he wound up, fast forward, in his own life until he was a teenager, and he became like an athlete and a scholar and went to medical school and became really one of the father figures of rugby football in England. So he had his own sort of meteoric rise at this British boarding school. And he was always, I think he had a sensitive, soft heart, a big Welsh heart, as they might say. He always, even though he himself was very courageous, he had a lot of empathy for people who were downtrodden and even soldiers who were shell-shocked in World War I and had exhaustion in World War II. And he was a very loving character and very much loved by his patients. He was a doctor between the wars, and the way he treated people in a rural community where he first served as a doctor and then in London as a obstetrician gynecologist. He just had a wonderful, caring reputation, and And I think he brought something of his personal doctoring and views on how you treat patients into even his war service, where he was very talented organizer. He had to organize field hospitals and systems of evacuation and casualty clearing stations and supervising assistant directors of medical services. So he had really risen through the ranks, so that by the time he was in the position where he was surprised by having to liberate this devastating concentration camp, he was deputy director of medical services for the British Second Army. He had a very high responsible post, and there were battles raging in Northwest Germany at the time of the liberation. So he had a real struggle with what to do with this situation, and sort of defying characterization, this military medical hero who had seen so much of war, had really seen the worst tragedies and people losing life and limb, really broke down crying when he saw Bergen-Belsen. The title is a quote of his when he testified at the first international war crimes trial, and he was the first witness, and he said, "I have seen all the horrors of war, but I have seen nothing to touch it." And so he brought all this to his experience of liberating Bergen-Belsen, and then, of course, observing what was happening there and orchestrating the relief, and then, he kept coming back to the camp. He somehow couldn't get away from it, even when his duties there ended, and it became a displaced persons camp. And
You know, Brigadier Hughes, I think, is now going to be a character that people will really relate to. Now that he would be on the task force, let's put it that way. You know, he would be.
He did that kind of advising after the war, right? He would be on the task force.
That's it. He'd be on the task force. And his story, his personal story, is fascinating. And the idea of nowadays, now we really understand what it means to organize a health care response. We see now the difficulties of it. How it's not something people, you know, before this, people said, "Oh well, you know, you do this, you do that," and now we can see how very difficult it is. And we're in peacetime, more or less, and to do all that he did in the middle of a horrific war is really quite amazing.
Well, thank you, Patsy. You really understand. And this is why when I read the newspaper every day, even though it's incomparable, right? They're completely different types of assaults and evils. Every day that I read the newspaper, something about the situation with our pandemic today reminds me of what was going on in Bergen-Belsen, even to like little details like that aren't such details, I guess, but like the fact that we've had to graduate medical school students early to bring them out and to help on the front lines to do whatever it is that needs to be done, whether it's cleaning rooms between COVID patients or whatever is needed. The same thing, I mean, Glenn Hughes brought in 97 medical students from London before they graduated, and to do whatever needed to be done there. And there's a lot of parallels. It's kind of strange because they're so different. But, yeah, we can criticize. There's even been criticisms of the relief efforts in Bergen-Belsen. Why didn't they save more people? Why couldn't they? And we see now with COVID the same kind of shock, unpreparedness, scrambling to collect resources, calling from emergency help from wherever you could get it, obsession with data as a way to, and not being able to get accurate data, but trying to collect data as a way to make sense of things. All these things, and how in Bergen-Belsen he had to establish a policy of triage, which was tragic, and we see that in some places now with COVID-19. Yeah, what is involved in medical rescue and relief?
Exactly.
And then, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I
so you're right. You're so right.
That's why I think, you know, all the horrors of war, a Jewish girl, a British doctor, and the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, it's a compelling story, and you've done just a remarkable job with it, Bernice. And do you have a webpage or something that you want to send people to?
Oh, sure, at www.bernicelerner.com.
And people can find out more there, more of your story,
yeah,
and the wonderful work that you've done in research. I think I have to bring you back just so you can talk about the research process, how you, because you've done an amazing job of research. And so I think many of my listeners who are writers would like a more in-depth, just to hear from that side. I don't have too much more time, but what I do want to say is that, now, this, of course, is nonfiction, but if, yeah, and I'm trying to become a bigger influencer, not just in the publishing world, but also I'm trying to reach out. I used to write screenplays. I'm trying to reach out to Hollywood, where when I see a book that I think should be turned into a script, this is a story. I think this would, you know, just be a remarkable story to bring out this fantastic doctor, and of course, all of the people who were, you know, at Bergen-Belsen. But you know, your mother's story, the story, and then the wonderful thing that you are here, that you are alive, and that you have so much to offer the world, and it's all because there was somebody like Brigadier Hughes, who cared, who loved, and who worked. He must have worked 24 hours a day. We're talking about this task force working. They must have worked, in those days, they worked around the clock.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think I was very taken with the story and the details, and the research is, it was like detective work, and you want to find out as much as you can and try to construct this life and figure out what makes, what, who is this character?
Well,
what did he bring? And, yeah.
I hope someone in Hollywood is listening out there. I'm trying to send more messages, reach more people. This is a book that should be optioned, and this is a story that should, I mean, if I had the time and the money and the energy, I would write the script for this book in a minute. And I could do it, because it is a story that I think needs to be told. And you've done a beautiful job, Bernice. It's been a real honor to have you on Joy on Paper today, because your book, and I sometimes think people, if I say all the horrors of war, they might say, oh, no, I don't want to read it. But there's so much in this book, and so much of value, and so much, it does give you hope of that there are great people in the world, wonderful people, and that all of us out there, all of the people who are in the medical field, know that, I'm glad in many ways they now understand that they're really appreciated.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And yeah, I know that the title, it could be scary, but there is a post-war chapter, and both Glenn Hughes and my mother did some interesting things in their post-war lives that are kind of inspirational, and stories that people can carry with them if they need to draw on their own courage. I think they're relatable characters.
Exactly.
So,
well,
again,
thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Bye bye
now.
Bye bye.
Wow, what an amazing story! What a movie this would make! I tell you, you know, sometimes I get these books. Jill Block's "The Truth About Parallel Lines" is one of those books that I got, and I would love to turn it into a script. I'd love to see it in you know, streaming video on a major motion picture, because I tell you, one of the things that you discover in this whole lockdown business is there's really a lot of junk out there on streaming video. You can't find anything interesting to watch. I've like just about run out, and I would love. The great thing about my mind is when I get a book that I love, it's almost, I know I'm reading the words, but the book actually is going into my head like a movie. And one of those books that I love this book, it's by Peter Riva, A Tribal Rumble, A Safari Campfire Story, Tale. Am I still on, Ed? Yeah? Something happened funny with my thing. Anyway, it's called A Tribal Rumble, A Safari Campfire Tale. The book is wonderful. The Audible book is amazing. I have listened to the Audible book, I think, 3 times now. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful story. And I hope that you will check it out. Peter Riva is a marvelous writer. He has 3 books in a series, all set in Africa. This is sort of a prequel, and it introduces us to a character called Mbuno. And I tell you, Mbuno has made such an impact on my life because over these past few months, when we're all like going crazy, and everything tastes like Lysol and Clorox. I don't know what I'm going to eat today to get rid of that taste. but to have a character like Mbuno, just to think about somebody who's strong, somebody who's just so brave, it really helps. And so I do hope that you'll check out Peter Riva's book and Valerie Truet's book, the tree story. You wouldn't imagine that a nonfiction memoir about tree rings could be so much fun. But I this is one of those books I read it once, and then I pick it up every once in a while. I look at the tree rings. They made a mistake not to make those in color, the photos in color. But the book is great. And Valerie is... She's got a great sense of humor. So she's writing about a very serious subject, but she's filling it in there with philosophy and funny stories, and you will really love it. Oh, boy. The hour's gone too fast. I do have to get out of here because the fumes are getting to me. Anyway, I just want to tell you and remind you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those words, those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a streaming video, a major motion picture that nobody can go to anymore, or maybe a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know. But you won't know unless you start writing. So start today. In a year, you're going to have a book. Think of that. That's so exciting. And it can be any kind of book, recipes, memoirs, nonfiction, fiction. Just get out there and start writing. And say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for cleaning up after all of us every time we walk in here. And everybody, just have a wonderful, wonderful weekend reading. And get out of your mind into a book. Okay. Bye-bye now.